And now, from the Green 960 studios in San Francisco, this is an organic conversation with Helga Hellberg and Mark Mulcahy.
And welcome to this week's edition of An Organic Conversation, a show about food, ecology, stories from the land, relationships, and life itself. We're your hosts, Helga Hellberg.
And Mark Mulcahy.
And it's still Earth Day week. Mark, what's going on?
It is, I guess, yeah, it's still Earth Day week. It's been a week, but it still feels that way to me.
I'm not letting go yet.
You're not letting go, and I don't blame you one bit. Well, most of our guests last week on the show said it was Earth Day every day for them, right?
That's right.
Well, you know, I didn't realize this until just the other day, but it's interesting that the anniversary of Chernobyl is so close to the anniversary of Earth Day.
Yes.
Within a few days.
Which was, what, 3 days, 4 days ago? April 26th, mm-hmm. 1986. Yes, the Chernobyl disaster happened in the Ukraine.
And you, that there's a personal story for you. I mean, I was here in the United States and I remember it vividly, but nothing to the way that you remember it.
Well, yeah, I think Hamburg, Germany is only, what, 800 kilometers or so away. I mean, it's really next door. And it was similar to the Fukushima disaster where you heard 3 days later that something happened 3 days prior. So, but what was interesting was that I believe the real fallout of how it affected our lives in Germany was never really reported here in the US. I remember for months and months, a couple times a day or so, we would get the cesium count in the rainfall. We would get...
You mean just like the weather forecast?
Yeah, or thing? Like with the ozone layer, we had that too, where we would say, you know, you don't want to spend time outside today, total sun exposure, not more than, you know, 29 minutes. So with the fallout and the cesium contamination, we couldn't eat mushrooms. We were not advised to eat dairy products for... I think almost 2 years, we were supposed to hose down our roofs off of radioactive rain that had fallen. So it was, you know, in a weird way, it became kind of part of our lives. And I was too young. It didn't really dawn on me that, you know, I mean, we knew it was a disaster, but what are you going
to
do?
You still went to school. You still hung out with your friends.
Yes. And we didn't need mushrooms. But, you know, at one time it became part of our lives, and we, in a way, had gotten used to that, and it was such a good reminder with the Japan disaster to think back and have it be, you know, coincide with Earth Day, that you know, the Earth wants us to consider our choices, and I believe now at this point Fukushima is categorized at the same magnitude as Chernobyl, mm-hmm. class 7. Mm-hmm. And we will look into that a little bit later, but it's the most shocking part for me is how it disappears from the news, just like the Gulf spill. Mm-hmm. You see it on the front page news for, you know, a week or 10 days, and then all of a sudden it's no longer even in the mentioning. It's just gone.
And this is now the year anniversary of that too, because they just had a bunch of stuff recently on the news and in the paper
about the Gulf
a year later. So
yes,
it's interesting that it's all having anniversaries around this same time.
So I hope there will be great work being done to document the consequences, because as you and I talked before the show, Chernobyl is still in a way a disaster in progress, and you know, it's still being recouped. And even though the nature around that plant in the Ukraine has rebounds to some degree, humans are still not allowed to be close. Mm-hmm. And I just heard yesterday or a couple of days ago that it will take about 9 months to really shut down Fukushima. It takes 9 months mm-hmm. for a nuclear power plant to be fully shut down. So because of all this, actually we invited a scientists from the Union of Concerned Scientists from Cambridge to the show. And with us now, joining us from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Dave Lockbaum. He's the director of nuclear safety at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Dave, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you for calling in and joining us on this show as we are looking at renewable energies and the future of energy in the United States and around the world. You know, Chernobyl, the anniversary, April 26, 86, brings in the forefront that we kind of knew that this could happen. Nobody really expected what happened in Fukushima in Japan on that magnitude to happen again, but it has happened before in Chernobyl. Where are we right now from your perspective, comparing it to Chernobyl, and what's the state of affairs in Japan at this moment?
Well, the problems at Fukushima are in many ways worse than Chernobyl. The amount of fuel damage at Fukushima between the three reactor cores that have sustained severe damage and the spent fuel in units 3 and 4 basically means more fuel has been damaged at Fukushima than in all prior accidents combined, which includes Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, the SL1 accident, the Windscale accident in the United Kingdom, and so on. Not the good news, but not all of that radioactivity has been released yet from Fukushima, and the workers are currently struggling to regain control and to limit how much radioactivity gets released in the future. The success or failure of their efforts will determine whether Fukushima slides well past Chernobyl on the badness scale or settles in second place.
And welcome to the show. This is Mark Mulcahy. I heard that it's a 7 on the disaster scale. Can you tell us what that means?
They use a 7-point scale. The Three Mile Island accident in the United States was a 5 on that scale. Chernobyl was a 7, and now Fukushima has joined Chernobyl at the high end of that scale. Basically, as each notch you go up, it means the event has caused more and more damage. Three Mile Island caused local damage. About 300,000 people were evacuated in the immediate vicinity of the plant. In Chernobyl and in Fukushima, there were people evacuated from even further away from the facility. The radiation released from Chernobyl and Fukushima has been detected around the world.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a measure of how much things get worse and how many more and more people are potentially in harm's way.
And what does that mean for the people of Japan?
Well, on top of the tragedy that the earthquake and tsunami caused, the accident of Fukushima has basically prolonged the suffering. It's going to be a long while before people get back into their homes close to the plant, perhaps never. In addition, there's going to be limitations on food usage and water usage because of the contamination from the radioactivity released from the plant. So it's, you know, they already have faced just an unprecedented tragedy, and the accident, nuclear accident on top of that, just prolonged how long that impact is going to be felt.
You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And with us on the phone from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is the Director of Nuclear Safety Project from the Union of Concerned Scientists, Dave Lockbaum. Dave, you just mentioned that 7 is the highest it can get, and yet it is possible that Fukushima, at the end of the tally, will by far surpass the consequences of Chernobyl, of the disaster in 86. How would that not be rated an 8 or a 9 or a 10 just because it doesn't exist?
I mean, it's not like Spinal Tap. You can't crank it up to 11.
To 11.
7 is as high as it goes.
But so if Chernobyl was a 7, how will we be able to assess or relate to this as, yes, a 7 too, but so much worse? It doesn't seem to make sense.
Well, both of those are, whether you're first or second on that list, the devastation, how far and wide the radiation has spread, how big an impact it had on the region, is about the same. So whether you're first or second on that list, it doesn't, unfortunately, change too much how bad the consequences have been. Around Chernobyl, even many years later, decades later, there are areas that you simply can't go into for very long because of the radioactive contamination of the trees and soils. You can't eat products or animals raised in that area. It's just it's a no man's land, and unfortunately, it looks like there will be an area around Fukushima that's equally uninhabitable for a while.
Yes, which is kind of the next question. You have been in, or you are a nuclear engineer by training, and you have worked in nuclear power plants for almost 20 years. You've written numerous reports, including The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, a report on safety on America's nuclear power industry. But it seems like a disaster such as Fukushima has consequences not just for Japan. How will this affect, or how is it affecting other countries, specifically and particularly the West Coast of the United States? I saw there was a kind of a milk alert a few weeks ago. I don't think that's still in place, but can you bring us up to date on that?
Yes, some countries like Germany has announced that they're going to try to phase out their nuclear power plants, thinking that the risk just isn't worth it. Italy, there's been similar talk about, there had been some talk about renewing or expanding nuclear power in Italy, and the accident in Japan is severely restricted those desires. In the United States, the good news on Senator Feinstein recently wrote a letter to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission urging them to accelerate the transfer of spent fuel from the pools into dry casks on site. That was one of the problems at Fukushima, was they had several spent fuel pools that weren't properly cooled, and the radiation, the fuel was damaged in those pools, and the radiation, because those spent fuel pools are not in a robust, very thick-walled concrete containment building, any radiation released from damaged fuel in the pools is much more likely to get carried by the winds far and wide. And Senator Feinstein has taken some steps to try to better protect Americans from that similar hazard. As far as the earthquakes was the initial problem in Japan, made worse by the tsunami and the loss of power. The plants, San Onofre and Diablo Canyon, are near active fault zones in California, and I think the Nuclear Regulatory Commission will take a relook at that to see if those plants can be made less vulnerable to the problems. One of the problems that the Japan accident showed us, or reminded us, was the need for diversity. At that plant, as in many of our plants, the emergency diesel generators, which is the backup source of power,
yes,
were in the basement of the plant. So when the tsunami arrived, the water flooded out and disabled the backup power supply. They were in the basement to provide maximum protection against earthquake forces, because if you store heavy equipment up high, it's more likely to wobble and move and fail. So they provided maximum protection against the earthquake, but it turns out that was almost minimum protection against the tsunami. Had they put some of the emergency diesel generators up at higher elevations and some of them in lower elevations, they would have increased the likelihood that some of them survived to save the plant. So I think those kinds of lessons will be examined and hopefully incorporated to make our plants
great,
safer in the future.
And so, thank you very much. So, what is the state of the nuclear power plants in our country? I mean, you just did a recent report. What can you tell us from the report that you did?
Well, the good news is, for the last several years, most of the plants, the majority of plants, have been operating very well. There are, for whatever reason, there's a small group that don't get the message or can't heed the message or whatever. And those are the ones where the American public needs the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to be an aggressive nuclear cop on the beat, to step in and induce those plants to turn around the declining performance and move back to the herd where the safety levels are safe. Last year, documented 14 near misses at nuclear power plants. One of the disturbing trends among those 14 near misses was that in most cases, the warning signs had been evident numerous times in advance. For example, the two reactors at the Calvert Cliffs plant in Maryland were shut down when it rained. Rain leaking through a leaking roof dropped onto some electrical equipment and caused it to short out. That problem had been noted for many years, many times, but every time it stopped raining, management lost, the roof only leaks when it rains, so management didn't fix it until it caused some safety problems. You can't ignore safety warnings at a nuclear power plant. 80% passing rate is not really good enough at a nuclear power plant. You really need to have a more aggressive, less complacent approach to safety. Otherwise, you pay a huge price tag down the road.
Yes, so true. We have a little bit of interference, but Dave, I think our listeners heard every word, and thank you so much for all the work that you've done. I know it's critical. We hear again and again that the industry is pretty highly regulated, but that the policies are actually not followed through or are not put in place, which is exactly what you just said. So, yes, the signs are often there, certainly, and we just need to really follow those. Again, Dave Lochbaum, the director of the Nuclear Safety Project from the Union of Concerned Scientists, calling in from Cambridge, Massachusetts today. Thank you, Dave, for joining us and for the
Thank
update.
You.
Pleasure to
Thank
have you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And now we are turning it into a renewable future. We have some exciting guests, and we'll talk about what's possible in the ecological energy conversation. Stay tuned. And we are back here to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we're still celebrating Earth Day, even though it was a week ago. I'm refusing to let it go. Ha. We just heard from the Union of Concerned Scientists, Dave Lochbaum, the director of Nuclear Safety Project, on the Fukushima disaster as we are, can we say, celebrating, as we are remembering the Chernobyl disaster from April 26, 1986.
Acknowledging,
yes. Holding it as a sign, as Dave just said, because the signs are out there. With us in the studio now, we're lucky to have Danny Kennedy, longtime social entrepreneur, one of the most outspoken person on alternative energies and the founder and CEO of Sungevity, the leading solar home specialist. He in the Bay Area actually located. Danny, welcome to the show.
Thank you again for having me.
It's great. Wow, I can only imagine how Japan has changed the conversation about alternative energies, including solar. Has it?
Well, yes, it has at the sort of individual level. I think people are just more aware of energy every day, really. You know, we've had a year of harbingers, you know, the Gulf oil spill, the massive coal disaster, Bruno here in the Bay Area, and then Fukushima, as if, you know, someone's trying to tell us that
the signs
old
are there.
King Kong, as I call it, coal, oil, nukes, and gas are dumb and disastrous and yesterday's energy. And now we need to move on with today's energy, which is the sun. It always has been and it always will be our energy supply. And, you know, slowly but surely we're taking on the world and providing the electricity and other energy that we need in our society. To be honest, though, I'm disappointed with the reaction here in the States from the powers that be, if you will.
Yes, what's the conversation in D.C. right now?
Well, the guy on the street gets it, and actually Wall Street gets it, which is good news. They're not going to be financing nuclear power plants anytime soon, given the risks and liabilities they see at Fukushima. But still in Washington, D.C., the Beltway bandits have their heads up there, darkest places, and are still thinking nuclear is part of the solution. So, you know, there's still this nonsense about a portfolio and so on. And really, we just have to get on with the clean energy transformation that we all know is coming. You know, ask anyone, 100 years from now, are we going to be still dependent on big nuclear power plants in our backyards? No, please God.
Or
yes. Coal-fired power plants? No, because as bad as Fukushima is, coal-fired power plants are doing that damage every day as business as usual. That's what they do by churning out carbon dioxide and causing climate change.
In Germany, where nuclear power since the Chernobyl disaster is highly controversial and actually widely not accepted, as Dave just said, decided to phase out the handful of remaining power plants that we have to be completely free of nuclear.
Right.
How can a country of 80 million people do that, that is highly technical, if we can't here in the United States?
Because they've already made the political decision to go clean.
Yes,
years
ago.
Years ago, they committed the feed-in tariff and the rest to set in train the wind and solar uptake, which is now working. And, the good news is Germany has really taken that step in the last couple of weeks or months since Fukushima. You know, there's also been political upheaval in Baden-Württemberg with the Greens winning a seat there and so on.
Yes.
China is also doing this. You know, they've put on ice a lot of their nuclear plans because they're looking across the straits and saying, well, if that can happen in Japan, which is technologically a lot more competent than we are, let's not mess with this stuff. Let's just do what we know we can do with wind and solar.
Yes, and the signs are out there, and we want to hear what has happened in the Maldives, because you had this beautiful story last time you came in a few months ago of you working with the prime minister, president of the Maldives, putting solar on his home, because not as just an act of progressive leadership, but actually almost as much as a necessity, because those island states are already directly affected. And we want to talk about that when we come back right after this short break. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And today it's all about the ecology of energy. Stay tuned.
My name is Earl Herrick, and I am the owner of Earl's Organic Produce, a San Francisco Bay Area distributor fully committed to organic produce. From the time one could find organic fruits and vegetables only in natural food stores to now, when schools and fine restaurants feature organic, we have been forging relationships with growers for over 20 years. If you want to offer the finest organic produce to your employees or customers, find us at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Fry Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Fry never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Fry organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Fry Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Sungevity, a company specializing in residential solar, is on a mission to bring solar to the mainstream market. Sungevity is changing the solar industry by making solar energy simple, efficient, and affordable for every homeowner. In most cases, Sungevity doesn't even need to visit your home to provide an estimate. Just plug in your address and we'll use satellite images and aerial photography to determine your home's solar potential. Go to Sungevity.com or call 866-SUN-4ALL to make going solar a reality today.
Do you feel run down, stressed, overweight, or overloaded? Urban Remedy is a delicious 100% organic juice cleansing program designed to jumpstart your body's natural healing and cleansing abilities. This delicious juice feast, created by leading acupuncturist Nika Pasquale, is rich in vital nutrients, minerals, and enzymes, providing you with all the nutritional nourishment you need to thrive. Delivered directly to your doorstep. Urban Remedy, a convenient way to boost your energy and balance your body. Place your order today at urbanremedy.com. That's urbanremedy.com.
And we are back here to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And today it's all about the ecology of energy. We heard from Dave Lockbaum, the director of the Nuclear Safety Project of the Union of Concerned Scientists, on this 25-year anniversary of the Chernobyl disaster, what the state of the Fukushima nuclear crisis currently is. And with us in the studio now, talking about part of the solution of how to mitigate the risks associated with kind of what outdated energies, how would you call those, Danny, is Danny Kennedy, the CEO and founder of Sungevity, the leading solar home specialist in the United States. And Danny, the last time when you came to the studio, it was such an amazing story you shared with the Maldives. Yes, you actually got to go on the roof of the president's place at the palace
right.
at the Maldives and work with the
that's right.
leader of that country to put a solar.
It's a it is a great story because it's such a you know nice precedent for the future really with. This guy, Nasheed, is his name, President Mohamed Nasheed of the Maldives, small country in the Indian Ocean, that are really at risk from climate change and are taking the lead on the solution to climate change, which is this transition to clean energy that we all know is coming. And he wanted to start with his own place, which happens to be a palace. And through a long chain of events, we were contacted and asked to provide a quote, which we can do remotely sitting in Oakland, California, and using our tool to provide an iQuote for his home. And a few months later, we found ourselves in the Maldives actually installing the solar system with him actually on the roof. And it was a great privilege, obviously, to be there with this very charismatic guy. Actually, they're making a movie about him called The Island President, which I think will be kind of the positive inconvenient truth, if you like, you know, a feature
yes,
film documentary.
We love that. What's that, the link? You said there's a trailer. Already, right?
Yeah, theislandpresident.com. And great. He, you know, is really this leading light, bringing the light to say, we can do this. There's an answer. It's called clean energy, and it's available now. And the good news is, in the dark days post-Fukushima, that a lot of people are picking up this lead. You know, a fact I wanted to share with you and your listeners is the solar industry was the fastest growing sector in the U.S. economy in 2010. That study just came out from the Solar Energy Industry Association a couple of months ago.
Oh, good.
Probably ties right in with the growth of the organic industry, too. And that
produce, yes. Mark's always excited when organic produce grows.
Of course. 38%.
Yes.
Right. We were just over 40, I think. So, you know, the scale of enterprise
That's
now
wonderful.
Is getting, you know, big. We're 90,000 employees, I think, in solar companies across the country, growing to 150 this year, they expect.
Yeah. Solar and produce, organic produce.
Right.
There's a connection.
Exactly.
So the way Sungevity does it, and we spoke about that in the last show, but it's kind of fascinating. You created your own software where you don't have to send anyone to a home anymore. You let the software run the estimate and say, this is your potential. This is what you will save. This is what you will cost. This
right.
is the offer we can make you. And you hold true to that, even if the reality, it might be close, but even if that's a little off, you hold true to that offer. Because you save the manpower to go out there, right?
Right.
So you can pass on the savings to the end consumer at the home owner.
That's right. This remote solar design capability just makes it more easy.
Oh, that's the word, yeah,
that's
of
how we describe
yeah,
it. Yeah. But, you know, we're sitting there using Google Earth type tools. It's yes. actually Microsoft's product. But it's a great example of using modern information technology to make
yes.
it easier to go solar and access the power of the sun on your rooftop. We design the system, send it to you by email as you're used to dealing with other forms of internet commerce. And then the other cool thing is we lease it to you. So you don't have to pay the upfront capital cost of the system. It's actually, you
zero,
can go solar for
down.
No money and then you know, off you go and pay us
Incredible.
Monthly like an electricity bill.
Yes.
And this is the future. You know, we will be accessing electricity services, the stuff that keeps you and I in our, you know, standard of living, but taking it from a clean source rather than a dirty one that's risking our kids and, you know, has the potential for spills and disasters of the sort we've seen in Japan and everywhere else recently.
So Danny, how has the technology evolved since the 70s? I think that was the first time I started hearing about solar power. I mean, it may have been around longer than that, but that's when I think I made its first splash with the White House and Carter. And how much has it evolved? Question one. And is it even possible that if everyone in the United States through a solar lease or through some sort of capacity switched to using solar in every state, could we, would it be enough energy for the country?
to the last question first, absolutely, there's more power falling on the earth every hour than we use in a day in terms of sunlight. And to the first question, you know, how's the technology improved? It's improved greatly, but it was already great then. I mean, I try to point out when you're talking about the ecology of energy, here's a machine. Think of a solar panel, not as a thing called a solar panel, but as a machine that creates electricity, kind of like those big power plants in Japan that run off nuclear power, or a coal plant out in the desert selling us electricity here in California. Here's a machine that takes sunlight and converts it to electricity at 15% efficiency. Back in the 70s, they were doing it at about 10% efficiency. So the answer to your first question is it's improved maybe by half in terms of efficiency of conversion of the power of the sun to electricity. But a coal-fired power plant is also taking the power of the sun that fell on this earth 200 million years ago
Was
photosynthesized into a plant and then was buried for a couple hundred million years in sedimentary rocks and then dug up by someone and aspirated in a machine that created electricity. It does it at a grossly inadequate level of efficiency. It's 0.00000015% or something stupid. And yet we do that. So you could take the fuel direct from the source with the machine that's black and sits on your roof and looks really cool and makes you a leader in your community. Or you could take the power from the source indirectly through a 200 million year long process, which results in carbon dioxide pollution, mercury pollution, ash generation, mountaintop removal, and all the other destruction that's in the coal cycle. That's your option, and you know.
But as a practical application, would it mean how many rooftops are we saying? Would we need to plaster the entire surface of the United States in order to live underneath it, or does the existing roof structures provide enough surface levels to build? Or like, what's the
As a matter of surface area, I don't have a direct answer. I mean, it's a small area. There are websites that do this visualization in a lot of places. It's a small area in the Southwest of land surface that would provide the solar electricity at that level of efficiency.
There's also the Nevada project, right, where they said there's this area in Nevada that has, you know, more sunlight than most other regions. And if it's several hundred acres, but that would basically suffice to provide enough energy for the entire Western United States.
Right. And you know, that's one way of doing it in a central station model, but that kind of replicates the last century's energy grid. I'm really into the distributed idea where, you know, you use it at the point of use, which is actually the roof above your head. And that real estate is actually cheaper even than the Mojave Desert. And we add value to it. I mean, there's a great study recently came out from the National Renewable Energy Lab that shows that house values go up 17% or something when you have a solar system on the home. You know, fantastic. So you're adding value to your home. You're getting your electricity from a clean source.
You can power your electric car.
You can power your electric car. You're saving yourself money and you're saving the planet. What's wrong with this picture?
Yes, very creative. Danny Kennedy, the founder of Sungevity, the leading solar home specialist, with us in the studio talking about the ecology of energy. And we have another call in. We spoke with a gentleman. He's not on the phone yet, we're hearing. Okay. Danny, back to you. You said earlier that the Maldives are facing a crisis, and actually I remember they are already in it, right?
Yeah.
Out of the entire island state, which is comprised out of hundreds of islands, if not thousands, several, you said a few months ago when we had you on the show last, had to be evacuated already, not necessarily only because of rising seawater levels, but because of saltification, is that the right term?
Salinity.
Salinity of the groundwater. Can you expand on that? Like, what's the situation in other parts of the world?
That there is already this incursion of salt water into the freshwater lens of various groundwater sources, and the Maldives is a great example of this. I think it's 16 island populations have been relocated already in that country. There's also erosive forces, you know, they just have, because of the higher sea level already, you know, more lapping at the shore and more erosion. So, you know, they're losing their land base. The highest point in the country is 7 feet above sea level. So there's not a lot there there. But, you know, nor is there here. In the Bay Area, if you look at the figures for what we're expecting in climate change this century and the sea level rise that goes with it, you get, you know, parts of the South Bay, you get, you know, Sacramento at risk behind the levees, you get a fairly high impact here too. So it's not just strange people off the other side of the planet here. We're talking about it's ourselves, and we've all got to take the lead in the transition to clean energy.
Great point.
So even if we didn't even touch on climate change, let's say we didn't even bring that into the conversation, I like to look at things in a practical manner, at something that, okay, what is logical? And for my entire life, I've been trying to look at, okay, nuclear power. Okay, what are the costs versus what are the benefits? Okay, coal. And you started bringing some of those things in earlier. And so it seems to me, unless you can tell me something, and I would appreciate if you would, is there one of those drawbacks to, I mean, are we looking at solar and looking at these alternative energy sources that there's a lot of things out there that are coming up these days? Does it just make sense to go that way? Because that's what my intuition tells me, and everything I read tells me, but I keep wondering why that doesn't make sense to more people.
Because there's vested interest behind the coal and the nuclear power is the short answer to your question. There are political and economic drivers to maintain business as usual in the status quo. I think, does it make sense? Absolutely. Those other technologies are, to me, very irrational. You know, they cause destruction and great risk and harm. You know, the coal industry is destructive, net. Solar has some downsides in, for example, mining of silicon. You know, that's an issue. But a ton of sand that becomes silicon to become a solar cell, to become solar electricity on your roof, will produce more electricity in its lifetime than 500,000 tons of coal. And then it's recyclable.
Okay.
So, you know, talk about ecology and the principles of ecology. You have something here that you can pull out of the ground once and then use in a product that has a 25-year warranty. We think they'll work for 50 to 100 years. And then you can take it, break it down, and reuse it. Whereas coal, you dig up 500,000 times more of it, and you burn it, and you get all this pollution and byproduct and waste and destruction.
You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Helberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we're speaking with Danny Kennedy, the founder of Sungevity, the leading solar home specialist here in the United States, about the ecology of energy. And we now have Bob Quinn on the phone with us. And Mark, you raised a good point. I always look at things at the true cost of production, right? That's really the true assessment for me. And most of any shortcuts of cheap foods that, if you look at it, are the most expensive way of producing or eating, obesity, environmental impact. It's the same with energy. If we look at subsidies to the nuclear industry, that industry would not exist without billions and billions and billions of dollars of free loans, of subsidies. So if anything can't exist without being artificially held alive, it's not a right solution. That's my take, because there are alternatives that can't stand on their own. So in the long run, we have to fall back on those. But it's a pleasure now to introduce, finally, Bob. Are you with us? Bob Quinn. Bob, we had you on the show before, I think a couple of times. You are one of the most forward-thinking farmers, land practitioners, I want to say, out there. You started to grow kamut and made it a recognized term and label for an ancient grain that you found. Can you summarize your operation one more time for us?
Sure, and thank you for having me back. It's great fun to visit with you guys. I started growing this ancient grain, which we fell under the trademark of kamut about 25 years ago. And the trademark means that we can guarantee that the grain, when you see the trademark, has always been organically grown, and it's pure ancient grain, hasn't been hybridized with modern wheat. And of course, we're very sensitive and opposed to GMO contamination, and we want to make sure it remains non-GMO and as pure as possible, and also as disease free as possible, and high a protein and high a nutrition as possible. And even though we started with a handful on our farm, now we contract with about 150 or 160 or so organic farmers in Montana, Alberta, and Saskatchewan, and this year we're looking at 60 or 70,000 acres being planted, and it's shipped all over the world. Primarily to my biggest market is Italy, to tell the truth, and it takes about 60% of the grain, and they make it into about 180 or 1,800 different products in Italy, and Europe takes altogether about 75%. U.S. is using about 10%, and Canada's using about 15%.
So Bob, thank you for that assessment. This is Mark Mulcahy. Welcome
Hi,
again
Mark.
To the show.
Thank you.
Today's show is about energy. And so you grow another crop on your farm. And so what other crop do you grow on your farm, and how are you using it?
Well, being organic, we grow several crops on our farm in rotation so that we can keep diversity going and weeds under good management. And the crop I think you might be referring to when you're talking about energy is my high oleic safflower. And I'm growing now about 7 or 8% of my farm is planted to high oleic safflower. And with that, I hope to be able to run all the machinery that it takes to farm the 100% of my farm.
So not just is the crop you grow always organic, anytime somebody sees Kamut, and of course most of it goes to Italy because Italians always know what's best.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll catch on here from their example.
Oh, we are catching.
Good.
But you found a way of actually running, I believe, your entire farm or parts of your farm on
the diesel engines, everything that runs the diesel.
On a fuel crop that you grow yourself.
Right. I'm going to take the safflower oil seeds, crush them on my farm, let the oil settle and the mash, the particulates settle out, and then I filter it. Now I'm going to be, there's always a big debate, you know, with fuel versus food, and I'm going to solve that debate by renting the oil out to all the local fry places around my area, and then after they get done using it, I'll collect it back, and then I'll filter it again and put it into my diesel engines and run it on my farm.
So Bob, now, I was just talking to Danny.
So
Danny
creative.
Is here in the studio with me about things that make sense and things that, you know, that, well, things that just make sense. And when you just said that, I'm sitting here with a big grin on my face going, okay, now why can't we do more of this? So is there a reason that farmers around the country couldn't grow, put in 7 or 8% of a crop and run all their diesel machinery on their farms using oil crops?
I'll tell you better at the end of this summer, because this is the first summer that we're going to do it on a kind of whole hog situation. We've just been experimenting over the last few years and seeing how it can work, and I've had to convert some of my engines. Others we might be able to just blend some diesel and SVO directly. But we're going to take that a little bit one by one. Each engine's a little bit different. But my idea is that the farmers could grow their own fuel and thereby get one of their large inputs under their own control again, which we haven't had that opportunity since the days of horses. And we're not going back to horses, of course. Actually, in the days of the horses, the farms were required to produce about grass and feed on 20% of their land for the horses to work the other 80%. And so the economy of this, of being able to grow on 6 or 8% of your land enough fuel to run the whole farm 100%, is really quite an improvement. I don't believe we can really fuel the cities. The economics and the math just isn't there if you try to raise all but your own fuel for the cities. But for the farms, I think it is a huge opportunity for the farmers to be independent and bring another level of food security, because we'll have our own fuel and have another big expense on our own control, and keep that money just rotating in the community.
Which in itself would make so much sense, but I love that extra caveat that you threw in of renting out the fuel, even the term, right? You're renting out the fuel to restaurants. They pay for it, so it already paid for it once, at least to some degree. Then you take it back, filter it, and then use it for fuel. Unfortunately, that's the time when it actually disappears.
Right.
But, you know, I'm sure you would make soap out of it or something when it's done otherwise.
Well, we do have some soap customers, but actually it goes back
to
carbon dioxide and water, and then next year's plant will suck that back up and complete the cycle. So it's all a continuous cycle.
Yes, and so resource management, the sustainability of the thinking of no longer producing one product, but making the entire chain as valuable as possible, right? Using, after you press the oil out of the safflower grass or seed, to use the seed for trout pellets or what? I mean, really, it's really up to our creativity, which is so exciting.
Sure. The mash could be used for feed, for fish food, animal food, chicken food. Or another thing I'm investigating is using it for pellet stoves. So it might be burned for heating of our homes rather than using, again, gas or petroleum products.
Oh, as a completely clean source, right? Plant-based.
As a renewable, completely renewable source.
Wonderful. Amazing people like you who can expand our language of possibility. Mark, I'm stealing that from you right now.
Absolutely.
Well, my idea is not to see every farm do this by themselves, but to show that it can work, and then put together a pilot program that would be a community size operation where farmers could go together and buy their own press, but the presses would reside in one press house for the community, which would be run by two or three employees for the whole year. And thereby we bring a couple more jobs to rural America, which is in desperate need of them. And we keep the miles off of the fuel. We don't haul the seed any further than to market. We're hauling it now. We don't haul the fuel back to the farms any further than it's being hauled now from the regional fuel distributors.
That's great. That's all food for thought. And you said the conversion rate is about 10%, meaning if you have a 500-acre farm, you need about 50 acres of oil crops to run your diesel equipment on that.
I don't think it'll be any more than that. I think it might be even less if you're in an area with a little more rainfall than we have and can get higher yields on your oilseed crops. And there's a lot of oilseed crops that can work depending on where you are in the country. You just pick the one that fits best for you.
Wonderful. Robert Bob Quinn, the president of Kamut International, and when you see Kamut in the store, try it out. It's beautiful, protein-rich, very nutty, and ancient grain that he developed, and it's always organic and grown under those sustainable practices. Bob, pleasure to have you. Thank you so much for your call today.
Thank you. It's great.
Thanks
to
for
talk
being part
you.
Of the show. Thanks.
Okay.
Robert was calling in from Big Sandy, Montana. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Helberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And still with us in the studio is Danny Kennedy. We'll be expanding on our conversation about the ecology of energy when we come back right after the break.
Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Fry never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Fry organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Fry Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Hi, my name is Earl Herrick. I started Earl's Organic Produce over 20 years ago to bring the best certified organic produce to the San Francisco Bay Area. Still today, Earl's Organic Produce is sourcing only organic fruits and vegetables. Our core principle is healthy relationships with growers, the environment, and the clients we serve. If you are a business interested in offering the most delicious organic produce to your customers, please visit us at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Sungevity, a company specializing in residential solar, is on a mission to bring solar to the mainstream market. Sungevity is changing the solar industry by making solar energy simple, efficient, and affordable for every homeowner. In most cases, Sungevity doesn't even need to visit your home to provide an estimate. Just plug in your address and we'll use satellite images and aerial photography to determine your home's solar potential. Go to Sungevity.com or call 866-SUN-4ALL to make going solar a reality today.
Marin Organic is an association of organic producers in Marin County, California, which has become one of the most progressive voices in the sustainable food movement in the United States. Through its many innovative initiatives, such as a school lunch and gleaning program, Marin Organic is creating a healthy, sustainable, and safe environment for all beings, today and for generations to come. please become a partner in our work by visiting marinorganic.org and by pledging your support now. Thank you.
And we are back here to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Helbrook.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And with us in the studio, Danny Kennedy, the founder of Sungevity, the leading home solar specialist in the United States and outspoken expert on solar and other energy issues. As we are tackling the renewable future, the ecology of energy today here on an organic conversation. And we just heard from Bob Quinn, the president of Kamut International, who grows on 7 or 8% of his land enough oil crops to run his entire diesel equipment on that crop for the rest of his farming operation. Isn't that incredible?
It's wonderful to hear, you know, what a visionary. And interestingly, of course, you know, going back to the original vision of the diesel inventor.
Which is a German product.
Of course.
Otto Diesel.
Diesel, who was an agrarian socialist that wanted farmers to control their fuel, just as Bob was talking about, so that they weren't dependent on outside capitalists buying oil-based
products. That was the reason
petroleum.
He came. That's where that came from.
He created that kind of engine to burn rapeseed oil fuels,
which they could grow.
Yes,
right.
the first diesel ran for like 6 hours on a half gallon or half liter. Actually, it's a German of peanut oil, and he wanted to prove that there can be an engine that has no maintenance, that doesn't even have spark plugs, because there's no combustion, right? In that sense, there's no ignition. Low maintenance lasts forever. That's why diesel cars have 300,000-400,000 miles on them and are still fine. That can run on basically any oil source that can be pressure combusted instead of fire combusted. Brilliant.
And it's why your man Bob can pour his recycled oil that he's already sold once to the restaurateurs down the street straight into his engine and run his diesel trucks on it. And you know, this is true around the world. I worked in the Pacific where the Japanese in the war back in the day used coconut oil straight out of the coconut to run the war effort. And, you know, to this day, Vanuatu as a country, 50% of their fleet runs around the country on cocoa oil pressed out of the husks. You know, it's a phenomenal power in our hands, this plant-based fuel, which is actually solar fuel, if you think about the photosynthetic process and the ecology of energy. You know, it's all coming from the same source, and there's a great direct application.
And you were also mentioning you recently were in Vietnam.
Right, which uses, like he was saying, pelletizing it and using it for fuel for fires.
After he presses the grass. Yeah.
Right, so the remaining mass after the oil's been extruded. In Vietnam, we saw that everywhere, the rice husks, you know, massive rice paddies everywhere, and all the industry, actually brick kilns, burning rice husks as their fuel, and all the cooking on rice husks, you know, just nothing's wasted. It all goes back in and you know, is a clean loop, because
which is
that's
really
what nature
the
does.
Full circle, exactly. The ecology of energy is just like the ecology of leadership or ecology in itself. There's no waste. That's the fundamental principle. And it's optimal resource management. In nature, there's no waste, right? One is the source for something new. Something dying is the source for some new life.
Well, even Steiner, you know, took almost all his cues from nature, right? When he created biodynamic farming and things like that. So, Danny, are any all these solar, algae, wind, biodiesel? Are these entities who are working in all these different fields of alternative energy talking to each other?
Sure. You know, I think there's political forces coming together, like the Clean Economy Network, which we're part of. And more importantly, I think just the popular groundswell for clean energy in the streets. I mean, you know, poll after poll, Gallup did one, I think, in January or February that showed, you know, 80% of Americans want policies to support the uptake of clean energy. You know, there are consistently findings of 70% or more Americans would be willing to pay more to get us off oil, get us off coal, get us off these destructive forms of energy. So, you know, we are coalescing as a community and society around this demand, and it's not red or blue or purple. It's across the board and across the country, because it's saving money and it's saving the planet. You know, it's smart. And people want to do it. So I would say to you, yes, but we're taking on a pack of forces in our society that are also very well organized and have had thrall over the politics of the place for a long time. You know, the coal and oil boys have pretty much run Congress for a while, and they make a lot of profit, and they're not going to give that up without a fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's not, you know, it's, I don't think it's about overcoming them because the agendas are so different, right? But if we keep showing the possibility and the cost savings, I love that Bob Quinn's story of growing his own you know, oil-based grass to run his operation is exactly the closest to sunlight harvested as it is in solar. It's interesting that the more we stay close to the source, the more ecological it is, right? Instead of saying what you said earlier, waiting for 200 million years and then extracting something that took 200 million years to get there in 1 year or in 10 years.
Yeah.
And releasing that carbon.
Or that creates a product that that stays around 500,000 years or has a half-life, you know, right, as in the case of Fukushima. Nuclear power plants, right? Yeah.
And you yes. know, to your point about the change process afoot in our country, you know, the best way we can make this change to clean energy is to, as Abe Lincoln said, you know, turn our enemies into our friends and, you know, get everyone aligned towards the same purpose. You know, it just makes sense yes. that we take 200 years of mistaken technological addiction and get over it and go cold turkey in some cases and just start using the biofuels that we can grow from native sources and use the sunlight that falls on our head every day for the electricity that it can create through these little black rectangles on your roof. That's the future.
And I want to talk about the future for one more minute. We're almost out of time, but Sungevity has been growing dramatically and amazingly to watch over the last couple, 3-4 years. And what are you focusing on? You're always more than just a solar company. You really embrace and embody that change. And it's, yes, you're doing this with the vehicle of your company, but it's an ideological choice you made, right? Years and years and years ago.
Yeah.
What are you focusing on now, both for the company as well as what's the most important thing to make our enemies, quote unquote, our friends, our allies?
Really, I think we're trying to build out solar as a social network. It sounds very au fait today, but you know, there's a lot of evidence that sort of viral uptake in the suburbia, if you like, in the neighborhoods. Once one person goes solar, people down the street say, oh, maybe I should do that. They ask about it over the fence. And, you know, oh, you're saving money on your electricity bill? Oh, wow, I could do that too. Oh, and you know, then it becomes faster because the permitting guy down at town hall knows how to handle it. And so we want to spread this virus.
And then it's weird not to, right?
Exactly.
You don't have solar.
At some point, it's going to be like that. It'll be like, I don't want to be the last person on the block that doesn't have solar. You know, like broadband technology has been adopted in the last couple of decades. So yeah, we're trying to make it cool and help people get it out there and get their friends to go solar too. So, you know, Sungevity.org we launched in earlier this year, and it allows schools and nonprofits to help their constituencies go solar with Sungevity, and they also get a referral fee if they get us customers. So things like that, tools online, Facebook apps, all that good stuff, you can find at Sungevity.com.
Check that out, Sungevity.com or Sungevity.org. The leading solar home specialist. Thank you, Danny, for coming to the studio. Always such a pleasure and insightful conversation. Really appreciate it.
Thanks. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
That was Danny Kennedy, the founder of Sungevity. And before that, we heard from Bob Quinn, the president of Kamut International. And the show was started off by David Lockbaum, the director of Nuclear Safety Project of the Union of Concerned Scientists, talking about the ecology of energy today.
An Organic Conversation is a production of the Organic Media Network. Associate producer, Gina Rastani.
For our blogs, podcasts, and more information on this show and previous shows, please visit our website at anorganicconversation.com.
You can also follow us on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. And we'd love to hear from you. Please send us your comments and questions to share@anorganicconversation.com.
We are your hosts, Helge Hellberg
and Mark Mulcahy,
and we'll be back right here, same place, same time next week. See you then, and thanks again so much for being part of An Organic Conversation.
Bye-bye.
Above us, only sky.